first case on the Southern Panel's oral argument calendar today is Garcia versus Auerbach, case number 71348. Mr. Roberts, Mr. Folsenberg, Mr. Henriod. Sorry, I haven't met you. Yes. How are you? Good. Welcome, all of you. I hope this worked out. I know you had a trial you were trying to work around, and I apologize, but just to explain, we're setting oral argument, and we're trying to get our cases wrapped up by the end of the year. So I appreciate your accommodation. I hope we haven't inconvenienced you too badly.
And if I could say, Justice, that it worked out very well because there were evidentiary issues the board had to deal with outside the presence of the jury. One of my partners is handling those this morning, so the jury probably is making progress.
Good. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Roberts?
I am, sir.
Okay, great.
May it please the court. My name is Lee Roberts, and I represent Plaintiff Amelia Garcia. The only issue before this court in this appeal is whether or not Ms. Garcia was entitled to judgment as a matter of law on a single element at issue in the claim against defendant Andrea Auerbach, and that element was permissive use of her automobile. The significance of permissive use is principally under NRS 485.30911B, which provides that any person using someone's vehicle with the permission of the insured owner, the policy also covers the person using it with permission, whether that permission is expressed or implied. That's why it was key. I won't go through the complete history, but as this court knows, Judge Alf initially entered a finding of permissive use as a matter of law on the basis of a discovery sanction. And she specifically found that evidence had been willfully concealed. And rather than completely striking the defense, as the plaintiffs had requested, she issued a lesser sanction, which she felt was directed particularly to the conduct at issue, that if we had had the claims note earlier, we could have had additional time for discovery to develop evidence in favor of permissive use based on that claims note.
And that's what I wanted to ask, and I'll ask the other side as well. If in fact, and it's not uncommon, obviously, in the Eighth to reassign cases, and if we believe that a judge can reconsider another judge's ruling, my question would be to each party, explain, at least in your position, why under these circumstances it was prejudicial to your client in your case.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the key thing, and I understand why the court wouldn't want to issue a very broad order on this, but in this case, when the initial order from Judge Alf was changed from a finding a matter of law to a rebuttable presumption, Judge Weiss said, I'm doing this because I had a conversation with Judge Alf, and I think this is what she intended, and I'm changing the express language of the order, which was clear, to something different because Judge Alf said that was her intention. And the problem with this case is Judge Alf had disqualified herself, and the court has to take that at face value, that she felt she had a conflict. And the conflict, presumably, is with Mr. Tindall, who's here. And this not only adversely affected us, but it resulted in Mr. Tindall's client losing insurance coverage for what turned out to be a $2.8 million verdict. And I believe that the real prejudice here is the fact that the judge had been disqualified and the rules, at least as it's clear in other states, and we've cited case law from other jurisdictions, is that a judge who has disqualified herself should no longer be influencing a case on the merits.
Mr. Roberts, could we back up a moment, if I may? I'd like to begin with addressing what the law is with respect to this type of order. Do you view it as interlocutory? And if so, let's take up the hypothetical. Could Judge Alf have changed her order before, or frankly, even during trial, or before the judgment was entered under 54?
Your Honor,
we've got a lot of jurisprudence that suggests that that's something a trial judge can do. Did you view the order as interlocutory?
Yes, I did, Your Honor. We could have sought certification as final, but we did not. It was interlocutory, and Judge Alf could have changed it had she remained involved in the case.
So you would agree with that jurisprudence that the trial judge can change an interlocutory order during the course of the trial?
Yes, Your Honor, although I do believe, regardless of whether it had been Judge Alf or Judge Weiss, changing it during voir dire, when the parties had relied on that order and what discovery they did, would have been prejudicial regardless.
So what I'm trying to understand is, at the time that, and I understand there's another problem associated with, as you described, Judge Alf's communication with Judge Weiss, but setting aside that point, when the order was changed, what did you articulate was the prejudice, either to your client, in terms of access to discovery or other issues?
That was exactly it, that these parties had ceased discovery on that issue when the sanction was entered, and we were now, discovery was closed, we were in the middle of trial. The particular thing, as explained...
Did you ask the judge for a break, or...
Yes, we asked for a continuance of the trial to continue discovery. He said, what discovery do you need? And we named the insurance adjuster who had actually written the claims note so we could authenticate it and get her testimony down because she was out of state in Arizona. Judge Weiss did give us an opportunity to go take her deposition without continuing the trial, but that would have prejudiced our other trial preparation. There was a compromise reached to avoid taking her deposition where Ms. Auerbach's attorney agreed that she would admit the authenticity of the claims note, admit that's what she said. But then she didn't do that. But at that point, Your Honor, we were just plowing ahead toward trial.
What do you mean she didn't do that? I didn't quite follow that part.
She did not admit that the words used in the claims note were the words she used.
Oh.
So did you take her deposition? You didn't take that. And you would have had you not got that presumption.
Absolutely. We took her deposition twice before we got the claims note. We did not have a chance to take it a third time. We did not know what she was going to say. And in addition, now, if it had been timely disclosed, the memory is fresher of the adjuster. Now we've got years later with the adjuster potentially having no recollection and us going to Arizona in the middle of trial just to hear, I don't remember. But if I could say that the problems with this issue and the interlocutory nature of the order is why I believe that the easiest way to resolve this is on the basis of the Rule 36 admission. And there was argument made by the respondents that we had somehow waived the enforceable effect of a Rule 36 admission where they admitted permissive use and they never got permission to amend or withdraw that admission. And the record is clear that on February 8, 2016 is when Judge Weiss said, I've been thinking about this and I'm going to switch this to a rebuttable presumption. On February 10th, 2 days later, before he issued a written decision, we filed a trial brief, which is contained in the record at Volume 4, beginning at page AA933, and then had oral argument, Volume 9, beginning at page 2138, in which we specifically told the judge, by the way, Judge, it doesn't matter, because they also admitted permissive use. And now that trial has started, it would be too prejudicial to allow them to withdraw it. The issue was raised. The issue was preserved. 2 days later, on the 12th, Judge Weiss entered his decision, finding that there was only a rebuttable presumption of permissive use, despite the fact that they had admitted this and they had never withdrawn it. And we pointed out in oral argument that Rule 36B requires that in order to amend or withdraw an admission, you have to file a motion. No motion was filed until we rested our case in chief. At that point in time, Judge Weiss refused to allow them to withdraw the admission. He said it's too late after they've rested their case. They would be prejudiced. You cannot withdraw the admission. But then, unfortunately, we believe that Judge Weiss was mistaken as to the legal effect of the admission. What he said in the record was, it's conclusive for the purpose of Rule 36, but they also answered an interrogatory later with new counsel saying that they didn't give permissive use, so the jury should get to hear that. And then, Your Honors, although he gave a proper instruction regarding the conclusive effect of an admission to the jury, he allowed them to argue that the denial in Rule 36 doesn't have to be in response to the request for admission in the timely filed document. He allowed them to argue in closing that because they denied it in an interrogatory answer, the jury could consider that a denial and therefore it not conclusive. And that's just incorrect as a matter of law based on the decisions of this court and based on a reading of the 1970 Advisory Committee, which when Nevada adopted the rule, the Advisory Committee in Nevada noted the reasons of the Advisory Committee in the 1970 federal amendments, which make it clear that it's got to be conclusive because it destroys the ameliorative effect of an admission if, despite the fact that you have an admission, you have to keep doing discovery, keep spending to develop the evidence, prepare to try the issue at trial, because you know they may be able to rebut their own admission.
So that leads to this question, and I understand your argument about the effect of the admission, but it seemed like Judge Weiss' concern had to do with the defendant's ability to address punitive damages. And so did anybody brief or debate before Judge Weiss the effect of an admission on and the consequence of the admission with respect to a punitive damage request?
Your Honor, we did not brief it. I know that I did express it orally.
I've been through a few trials as a lawyer and as a trial judge where that issue's come up before, and there's some law on that.
And I did express that the way Judge Howell's order was written, permissive use would be binding in the punitive phase. However, the thing that I believe Judge Weiss missed there is that permissive use only goes to the statute on insurance and our ability to have one of the defendants insured who caused the damage. The claims against Andrea Auerbach on which punitive damages were based on negligent entrustment. And permissive use is only one element of negligent entrustment, and they still had the ability to try to disprove the other elements. And in fact, if the court looks at Behena v. Goodyear, we had a dispositive sanction based on discovery abuse. A judgment was directed on liability in the compensatory phase, but yet they were allowed to dispute punitives, and in fact, the jury found no punitive damages. So there's certainly ways to craft around this issue of allowing them to dispute punitive damages based on the merits without completely destroying the sanction. And
forgive me, Mr. Roberts, but were those alternatives vetted before the district court?
I don't believe they were, Your Honor. But that would only go to the sanction issue. It would not go to the binding effect of the admission, which they're stuck with for the punitive phase also.
You have a minute 5:30. We've asked you a couple of questions. We'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal if you intend to request rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing that I did want to bring to the attention of the court as I read the briefing was I cited to the district court opinion in the Avant case cited by the respondents, and although it was affirmed and that was proper, I did want to point out that the affirmance was 572 F. 2nd 889, First Circuit, 1978, and I believe that the affirmance does support our interpretation of the district court decision, where on the last page of the circuit court affirmance, Avant complains the district court erroneously excluded certain responses by Polaroid to request for admission, but the record indicates that exclusion was due to Avant's procedural default and consequence waiver of its rights to have the admissions admitted into evidence. And in this case, and in the other case cited by respondents, the admission was not brought to the court's attendance until after the evidence had attention, until after the evidence had closed. It's certainly not applicable to this case, where immediately, even before the judge issued the initial written order, we raised the admission and it had never been withdrawn. There's no cross appeal pending on Judge Weiss's refusal to allow the respondents to withdraw the admission, so that is the law of this case. The admission was not withdrawn, it is binding, and we would request that this court issue judgment as a matter of law on the narrow issue of permissive use. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. You'll have one minute, Mr. Roberts, for your rebuttal, and you'll have 16 minutes, Mr. Paulsenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Dan Paulsenberg for the respondent. Let me start with a point, because I think it's important why we are here. Appellant comes up and says it was a statute. This all had to do with the statute in 485, an insurance coverage statute. No. It had to do with 41.440, which says that the intentional or negligent actions of a family member can be imputed to another family member who owns the car. And that's what was going on here. That's why Judge Weiss changed the prior order, the prior sanction, because he didn't think, he thought there were two problems wrong with the sanction. Number one, it didn't take into account that it would impose vicarious liability for punitive damages on the mom when she didn't do anything that could be considered conscious disregard. He also thought that it had to do with, that the sanction really should have gone to negligent entrustment rather than permissive use. Permissive use is an element of 41.440. And negligent entrustment is an entirely separate claim. It would be suing mom for her own negligence in safeguarding the keys, and probably wouldn't be any punitive damages involved there. So in light of those two, what the Judge Weiss considered to be mistakes, he thought it was important to reconsider the sanction order. And under those circumstances, it makes absolute sense. This court has said that a judge can reconsider her own orders once she becomes more familiar. And so it's very reasonable and common for a judge either not to rule on something early on and wait until trial, or reconsider at trial. And we have the Richmond case where we talk about some objections you can't, for attorney misconduct, you can't even make before trial because you don't know what's going to happen at trial.
What about their argument that this is overly prejudicial, that this is in the middle of trial?
Oh, no. Well, first of all,
you heard their argument that they would have done more discovery on it, or
Judge Weiss wasn't being unfair, though, Judge. It's not like he said, too bad, you're a trial lawyer, you can handle it, although I've had judges say that. It's trial, you're a trial lawyer, you know things change, you can handle it, and this court has affirmed those determinations. But here he said, they made the blanket, we need to do more discovery, we would have done more. He said, okay, what do you want to do? I'll let you do it. What do you want to do? They said they want more discovery from the insurance company. They want to depose the adjuster again that already deposed her. He said, fine, go ahead. You can depose her. They didn't. They wanted to depose my client again. The judge said, fine, go ahead. You can depose her. They didn't. They can't come up with anything that they would have done if they had more time. And Judge Weiss was going to be flexible. But they don't bring in anything that they were denied doing. So if there wasn't prejudice to them, in fact, it would have been the prejudice to us if he hadn't done that. Look, even under Rule 36, the line that appellants keep leaving out of Rule 36B, they, after the sentence that says you can make a motion, there's another provision. And it says that the court, the district court, may permit withdrawal or amendment when the presentation of the merits of the action will be subserved thereby, and the party who obtained the admission fails to satisfy the court that withdrawal or amendment will prejudice that party in maintaining the action or defense on the merits. So what the judge is saying is, I understand the need for the sanction, and their only argument is deterrence. And whom they're trying to deter is my client's prior counsel, who, without checking with my client, did the Rule 36 admission. Without checking with my client, materially altered, well, material is probably too far, but altered evidence produced in discovery.
Was that in the record, and where would that be found in the record, what you're saying?
Yeah, it is definitely in the record, and Joel's going to look that up. And then afterwards, when there's the amended complaint, when we answer the amended complaint, we deny permissive use. So I think that Judge Weiss was actually considering that it may have been an appropriate sanction on a different issue, such as negligent entrustment. But on this issue, it makes her liable for punitive damages irrespective of her own state of mind. And their only argument about the prejudice is that the jury would get to determine the truth. Now, to borrow a phrase from Oliver Twist, you know, if the law presumes that, supposes that, the law is an ass. I cannot believe that this court or the legal system would say that a judge exercising his discretion would come up with a way to serve all purposes and still have a fair trial. Now, their argument is, well, it doesn't have to be fair. It's a sanction. Well, you know, if judges were really had their hands tied and could not reconsider determinations or could not grant relief under Rule 36, then I'm not sure I'd want to be part of that judicial system, either as a judge or as a lawyer. Because really what they're saying is that Rule 36 is a rule that if you miss the deadline, or if you admit, if you have incompetent counsel who admits a request for admission, that that fact is established and the judge has no ability to do anything about it. Well, that defies common sense. And Rule 1, that all the rules are interpreted to affect the fair, speedy, and inexpensive resolution of justice. So under all those circumstances, I think the district judge did not abuse his discretion in modifying the sanction. It still was a sanction. He didn't say, okay, you're released entirely from either the Rule 36 determination or from the sanction. The judge said, okay, it isn't conclusively established, but it's still a rebuttable presumption. They enjoy the presumption, they took advantage of the presumption, and the jury just heard all the facts. And I know they keep saying it's not a wholesale excuse under Rule 36 that the admission was untrue, but it doesn't mean that the judge can't consider that. Mom repeatedly said that she did not give permission to Jared to use that car.
Didn't Mom say that Jared, she gave him permission to use it when he was practicing for his driving test? She gave him the keys that day. They're on the mantle. I mean, I'm just looking at the first admission that was redacted and not turned over to the parties.
Okay. Let me take them in two parts.
Okay.
She repeatedly, okay, that day, definitely, she said, no, you can't drive the car.
The day of the accident.
Right.
She said, I didn't tell him that day he could.
Right.
But she had otherwise admitted.
Sometimes she let him have the car when somebody else would be driving, including the mother of his children. She went with Jared in the car when Jared was driving, when he was studying for his driving test. But the amount of evidence of her refusals to let him use the car himself, and certainly that day, I think is overwhelming. And I think the jury considered all that. The jury considered the presumption. The jury considered the admission, and just wasn't going to impose liability in a situation where it's not appropriate.
Mr. Polzenberg, do you think there should be any, and if this is, if you're going to get to this, you can, don't have to answer it now, but should there be any guardrails on the judge's ability to sua sponte revisit orders? A judge comes into the case. Can they just thumb on through and change every order without instigation by the parties, new evidence, new authority, or issues coming up?
I think the court said that a judge can do that, even in Harvey's wagon wheel. Said as a judge, oh, that wasn't a new judge, that was a judge reconsidering a prior determination, but that can be done sua sponte. Judge Weiss didn't do a wholesale reconsideration of everything. They know that when he took over the case, he said he's going to let the prior ruling stand. I've had many district judges say that when they take over a case and then realize that some of those rulings are just not rulings that they want to have in a trial. Now, there are two types of rulings. There's clear error where a district judge, even a substitute district judge, has the responsibility to change the determination. But in the exercise of discretion, I don't think you should be stuck with a trial where you think it's just going to come out with an unfair result.
Was Judge Alf's order clearly erroneous?
Oh, the sanction order?
Yeah.
I think that it was in her failure to consider the effect that it would have on punitive damages. I think she didn't work it all the way out, and it was also on the wrong thing. Now, on its face, early on, it looked like it was okay, but I think even Judge Alf at trial would have had trouble. We're in front of Judge Alf right now in trial. She's very conscientious and works things out, works very hard into the night. I think she would have realized when she got to trial it doesn't work on the punitive damage claim. It simply doesn't work. So, but I don't think you need clear error to change an interlocutory call that affects the way you're going to try the case.
Do you agree it was improper for Judge Weiss to discuss the matter with Judge Alf?
I don't really. It looks bad at first blush, but I don't think it's the kind of situation where we have the disqualification that we would talk about. What if a judge were disqualified for an actual reason other than the new lawyer who shows up for Jared is on her disqualification list? If there was some real bias there, then maybe the judge shouldn't participate. But that wasn't here. It was, and the disqualification had to do with Jared, not with my client. So the determination doesn't have the same appearance of impropriety. And besides, if you can impute some kind of situation because we're both defendants and we're mom and son, then the apparent bias would be against me. It wouldn't be against them. So the fact that she was candid and said, yeah, that's not what I meant. One, I didn't consider punitive damages. Two, I didn't really mean it to be a conclusive establishment. I meant it to be a rebuttable presumption. I don't think that those are unethical communications. Now, I am sometimes a critic of when judges talk to each other, but the ethics rules do allow judges to talk to other judges and other judicial officers. I've many times in the district court had a ruling, and I can tell that result came from another district judge because I know how she thinks. But there isn't something that puts this over the edge of impropriety. What is this a site to? Of Is that what the question was, that the admission was not verified? Okay, here, let's write that. Oh, yes, that she hadn't consented to that. Yeah, here, I have two citations. Mm-hmm. That she had not consented to the Rule 36 admission. One is at 9 of the appendix, 2139 to 2141. And 24, bottom 24 of the appendix, 5934 to 5942.
Is that her testimony?
The second one is.
Mm-hmm, the second one.
See, he can do the echo for me just like I do it for him. So if there aren't any other questions, I really don't think this is an insurance coverage case. And they're introducing this now in oral argument and for the first time in reply. It is not what was argued below. What is argued below is 41.440. And I don't like that statute, and I've argued to this court that it's unconstitutional. And this court's unanimously rejected my argument. But I think if punitive damages were imposed under the literal reading of the statute, we would have a constitutional issue here. And Judge Weiss keenly realized that that was a possibility and came up with a retailoring of the procedure of the case in order to avoid that situation. And under those circumstances, I think the judge correctly exercised discretion. And it would be, as I alluded to earlier, this would be a terrible judicial system if judges weren't able to readjust cases to come up with what the judge thinks, and in retrospect, I think, was the correct way to resolve the issues. This case was decided on the merits. Their complaint is that it wasn't.
Do you have a cite to where the plaintiffs had asked for continuance to do X, Y, and Z?
I do. I have several.
Adjuster. We'll get the adjuster.
I have a whole section of the brief on that.
Right. Okay.
And it's laid out in the answering brief. And if you will let me suffice with that answer, or if you want, I can send a letter after the argument during today with those citations. Okay. The
brief is sufficient on that.
Very good. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Roberts?
Thank you. 1 minute, Your Honor. Be very brief. Judges do have the ability to retailor orders that are interlocutory. The Supreme Court of Nevada, in determining the binding effect of a request for admission, cited the Jensen case in our briefs from Utah. What that said is courts had the ability under Rule 36 to grant relief to allow an admission to be withdrawn or modified. What judges do not have discretion to do is ignore an admission that is not withdrawn and is not modified. And none of the arguments raised by respondent can justify the court's refusal to give binding effect to an admission that it had just refused to allow the respondents to withdraw or modify.
Well, Mr. Roberts, you heard Mr. Polsenberg's reference to other portions of 36B that suggest that a trial judge can, without a motion, relieve a party of an admission under 36. What's your view of that language?
That the judge actually has to do it. And that in this case,
so you're, Mr. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your statement.
Sorry, Your Honor. In this case, specifically, we cited the portion of the transcript in the briefs. Mm-hmm. They specifically said, well, what you're really doing is allowing a limited amendment. Right, Your Honor? You're allowing a limited amendment to essentially allow us to put in the interrogatory answer. And Judge said, no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not allowing you to withdraw it. It's too late to move after they rest their case in chief. It's too prejudicial. I just think that you can bring in the contrary interrogatory answer. He thinks Rule 36 and the interrogatories are sort of equal, and they put both in front of the judge, and it's
so,
up to the jury.
So I guess the thing that is potentially problematic on appeal is the judge didn't debate the language that Mr. Polsenberg read out of 36, but the effect of what he did stems from that authority.
It is, and Your Honor, I would go so far as to say it was debated on the record, and Judge Weiss disagreed that he was exercising his discretion to modify it in a limited way and strike a compromise, as they said in their briefs. He rejected that position. He was just mistaken as to the legal effect of an admission that he had refused to allow them to withdraw and modify.
I had one other question about this. The imposition of a sanction for a discovery violation is itself a discretionary act by a court. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so when we talk about jurisprudence from other jurisdictions that focus on correcting errors as a condition to adjusting interlocutory orders, I'm just thinking out loud that adjusting the sanction, the level of sanction that's imposed for a discovery violation is itself kind of a floating event, isn't it? But I wanted to get your take on that. Having served as a district, all three of us have served as district court judges, and you might feel one way about the sanction you want to impose for a discovery violation, but I have to say that over the course of a case, one might feel differently about the sanction.
I do think it floats, Your Honor, ordinarily.
Yeah.
But under the facts of this case, I don't know if it can float. Once you file an interlocutory writ, which is addressed on the merits in case number 68-602, which rejects the very arguments they've made to Judge Weiss, I think it's too late. I don't think it's floating anymore. The law of the case, at least, is it's not erroneous. So that would at least carve out that exception.
And I didn't have a chance to check the record on this. Forgive me if I have overlooked something. Was there a special verdict in this case? There was a special verdict.
Yes, sir.
As to Mom?
The interrogatory is asking about permissive use and negligent entrustment. Yeah, permissive use was interrogatory fine.
Great. Would you guys confer before leaving the court and give us the record cite on the special verdict, if you could, please?
Yes.
Anything else, Mr. Roberts?
No, Your Honor. I appreciate the extra time and your indulgence.
Any other questions from my colleagues?